So I'm really glad that I'm following right after Rav Shachter's excellent talk, because now I'm going to deal with a lot of the issues that surround the precise questions that he is asking. That of, well, in a sense, the origins of the what I call a religious tension that exists in the thought and the writings of three particular early Zionists. Now, what do I mean when I'm talking about early Zionists? I mean two things. Probably more than two, but I'm going to focus on two. First of all, I mean people who actually positively identified themselves as Zionists. You may not know this, and if you do, I apologize, but the term Zionism actually is from a German, well, it's originally from a Hebrew word, but the use in the modern vernacular is from a German word, excuse me, check in a second. It's from a German vernacular, or I mean, it's modern incarnation. I deal with this in my classroom all the time, so I'm going to talk while I'm doing it. In the modern vernacular, I was used in a German periodical called Selbstemanzipation. Selbstemanzipation began publication around 1885, lasted about a year, died, came back in 1890, and it was in 1890 that a thinker journalist by the name of Nathan Birnbaum first coined the term Zionismus to refer to a phenomenon of Jewish nationalism that he was instrumental in developing in its infant stage. The second thing I mean is, so what that does is it excludes what are often referred to as the so-called harbingers of Zion. I believe it is an anachronism, an inaccuracy to refer to figures such as Rav Zvi Hirsch Kalischer or Rav Yehuda Alkalai as quote-unquote Zionists, or even the more famous case of Moses Hess as Zionists, because the term simply did not exist. So we're going to talk about the early Zionists, meaning three thinkers who were instrumental in developing the early thought of this idea of Zionism between about 1882 and I place the end of the period of moderns of early Zionism with 1904. It's a convenient date because that's the year in which a couple of things happened. It was the year in which, first of all, Theodor Herzl died. And with that, it was the moment, a turning point of Zionism from a kind of fractured, what was becoming a fractured movement into a more unified movement, something that we would recognize today as some of the principles of Zionism, including Hebrew language, was not always a given that were a modern Jewish state to emerge, Hebrew would be the language. The idea of having a Jewish state in Eretz Yisrael, again, it was not a given. It was not a given that some Jewish autonomous project would emerge specifically in Eretz Yisrael. Obviously, that was always the goal. But in the interim, perhaps somewhere else, for the protection of the physical protection of Jews, of Russia primarily, right? Those things which we take to be, you know, what is Zionism without those? Right? Really coalesced and became the centerpiece of the Zionist movement around 1904. We're going to talk about the period right before that. The three figures we are going to talk about. Theodor Herzl, not in this order. Theodor Herzl, Asher Ginsberg, otherwise known as Tata'am, and finally, Nathan Birnbaum. And I'm going to sort of develop the point that's been acknowledged, it's been noticed, that despite the fact that all three of these figures, if you were to ask them circa 1900, how they conceptualized the Jewish state, they saw it in terms of it being a modern nation state. A modern nation state. The role of religion was a par of a question. At least in two of them. In the case of Tata'am, it was a very intense question, but we'll see what. But all of them envisioned the state being something mostly reflective of a kind of liberal, democratic state with a greater or lesser degree of something called Jewish culture attached to it, right? But the question of religion was something that was left out. And what I would like to suggest, or at least I would like to develop, something that has been noticed before, is that at the core of all three of these people, in their biographies, I got everything wrong. At the core of all three of their biographies, the question of religion always works. It's always present. Whether they want it to be or not, it's always present. And in each comes out in a very interesting and different way. And what I'm going to do is kind of develop how that question comes to the fore through looking at some details of their biographies and brief examination of selections of writing from each, dealing specifically with the question of religion. Okay, just to get us started here, the origins of the The origins of Jewish nationalism stem back, in a sense, to the period preceding the revolutions of 1848. It's a period known as the Four Months period. Just to give a brief idea, all of the kind of events occurring between 1830 and 1848, where different states, primarily in southeastern Europe, the greatest example being Greece in 1830, a new idea of how people organize themselves within the context of a larger world shifted a little bit. And it became the principle that the fullest, best way for a given group to identify themselves was through something called a national identity. Now, I'm not going to argue that in the case of the Jewish people, some component or a core component of a kind of national identity hasn't always existed. Clearly, that's certainly not just an argument. However, there was something that was switched on around the period 1830 to 1840. And the primary two, I just put these images up here. This is Lajos Kossuth, leader of the 1848 revolution in Hungary, Garibaldi, the Greek revolution in 1830, and Moses Hess, himself a sort of disassociated Jew, a German Jew who really, although raised in a traditional milieu, walked away entirely from it and became among the earliest founders of internationalist socialism. However, in his later life, around the 1860s, he started combining an idea of some kind of Jewish national identity with his vision for a socialist utopia and actually began to argue that it was the return of the Jewish people to Eretz Yisrael that would bring about utopian socialist age. It's a deeply religious argument with devoid of any religion. It's fascinating. So lest one want to look for some sort of core of theology in socialism, you can really look at Hess as a very keen example. In the case of the specific relationship of religion to Zionism, two figures usually come to the fore. I've mentioned them already. The so-called harbingers of Zionism, Rav Yehuda Alkalai, a Sephardi Rav from the region of Monastir, a town called Zimin in the Balkans, and Ratzvi Hirsch Kalischer, who became a rabbi of a town called Torn. Torn was in Poland, but it was annexed by Prussia, the preceding state to the German Empire. Both of them share the common connection that their presence in a shifting Central European political landscape, witnessing these changes that are occurring, this sort of turn towards a national identity, deeply impacted them. Yet they conceptualize national identity in strictly sacred Jewish terms. So the famous text of Kalisch, for instance, the Rishat Zion, right, defines the parameters for which a real rebirth of a Jewish national principle, a Jewish national idea, centered on the return to Eretz Israel and the resumption of sacrifices, frankly, actually called for that, and adding the third element of a kind of lobbying idea that if you talk to the right people with the right amount of money, you can raise money to actually affect this. So we actually proposing a positive, functional way to start building a state and couching this. And you have to understand that to argue this in his period, we're talking around the 1850s, 1860s, to argue that there was actually a halakhic basis for returning the Jewish people to Eretz Israel, resuming sacrifices, not only that, but it was obligatory based upon the way he was reading the sources, it was extremely controversial. Right? It is not until the 20th century that something even approaching a significant number of what would come to be called Orthodox Jews or traditional Jews would accept the idea that this was even something that could be tolerated.
Did they know each other?
No, interestingly enough, they did not seem to have known each other, yet they're arguing almost the same thing. It's very interesting. We Jewish historians, historians of times, tend to note a particularly important shift that occurs circa 1881, 82. Stimulated by the collapse of Jewish security, right? By that I mean the ability to actually live your life and do the things you do on a daily basis. In southern Russia, in the Ukraine, after the assassination of Alexander II in 1881, stimulated a massive shift in two regions. One was the beginning of a massive demographic shift. Jews left the Russian Empire in numbers that had not been seen since the late Middle Ages, the early modern period, where Jews were moving into the regions that would become part of Russia, of Jewish Russia. They were now leaving. Where were they coming? Mostly the Lower East Side. Mostly the Lower East Side. In fact, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 to 1.5 million Jews between the years of 1881 and 1914 came through the Lower East Side. Right? The other shift is a sudden attentiveness to the idea of nationalism, but not from the same place that it had come in the post-48 period. In the 1881-82 period, it was seen to be coming from a very, very different home, mostly through the influence of one man, a doctor in Odessa, a very well-respected, if you want to call it integrated or assimilated or Russian-speaking, however you want to characterize that, doctor who authored a pamphlet called Auto Emancipatio. We have the original front page. Now, it's interesting to note that even though he was a Russian-speaking person who advocated the use of Hebrew as a tool of enlightenment of the Jews of Russia, he wrote a pamphlet in German. I ask why that was. I would suspect that a lot of it had to do with who he was appealing to, which were primarily Central European integrated or assimilated Jews. Jews of Vienna, Berlin, those. His position, I'm going to skip the text, but the position that he's basically outlining is what I would call a racialist, nationalist, very European model of what determines, what defines the Jewish nation. Like most of the thinkers of his day, he falls back on the assumption, as a doctor, he falls back on the best of late 19th century science and medicine, and imagines the nation as an organic entity. Not really bothering to define what the core components of that organic entity are, but saying that it's a fact. It's a fact that the nation is an organic entity. The Jews, having been dispossessed of their homeland and in exile for nearly 2,000 years, were a kind of body without a body. They were an organism that couldn't be, that shouldn't be, that they were maintained by means that defied understanding, particularly when you think of the nation as a kind of brute, you know, organic beast that sort of does what it does. The Jews were, he refers to them as an apparition, as a ghost, as something that these other nations couldn't handle. That was his explanation for anti-Semitism. And it was the duty now that it became clear to him. It had become clear to him that anti-Semitism would never end so long as Jews were maintained in this unnatural situation. So it was the job of Jewish nationalists like himself to agitate, to exercise, to work towards recreating the Jewish nation. What the core of that is, I want to note very carefully, he does not ever really say so explicitly. Yet, that moment, that he publishes this pamphlet, Auto Emancipatio, in German, is widely read by aspiring, I wouldn't even call them aspiring nationalists yet, but I would call them as people who were similarly disturbed by what seemed to be the failure of the promise of 19th century. Promise of the 19th century for Jews in Central Europe was a promise of increasing liberalization of the governments, increasing integration of Jews into the broader European landscape, movement upward, social mobility, engagement, moving to the use of primarily the German language as a language of discourse. That promise seemed to have been betrayed by the events of 1881, but especially also by the turn towards anti-Semitism that was prevalent in places like Vienna and Berlin. Auto Emancipatio kind of hit on a particular nerve, in other words. And one of the people who it most affected was this man, Nathan Birnbaum. On the other hand, we have Asher Ginsberg, Achad Ha'am. Achad Ha'am was actually a close associate of Pinsker. So Achad Ha'am was one of the people who was engaged in Russia in starting to ask these questions, starting to answer how he was the one who was supplying the content to the vessel that Pinsker was out on. He was the one who was going to define what it is exactly we're talking about when we're talking about the Jewish nation. And then finally, the sort of orphan, yet the person who was probably the most successful in bringing any of this to fruition, Theodore Herzl. Yet all three of them, as I mentioned before, at the time when they were Zionists, would have talked about, they were talking about a modern secular nation. It was just a difference of how you defined that. Our first figure, Achad Ha'am. Achad Ha'am is an interesting character. He was born to a family in the Kiev province of what is now the Ukraine, what was then the Ukrainian portion of the Russian Empire. His father was a very, successful person. He was a wealthy importer-exporter, businessman in the sort of, main kind of business of the region. And his son, Asher Ginsberg, was born into an intensively Hasidic family. His father was a follower of the Sadegur Rebbe. This is a picture of his castle or beautiful mansion that he had in Sadegura, which is a little bit southwest of Kiev. He left that behind. We follow what we would understand as a kind of classic maskilic pattern. He was an autodidact. He sort of taught himself to read German. His father didn't want him. His father instructed his tutors not even to teach him the Russian alphabet out of fear that it would lead him to the courses. His father was right. That's exactly what happened. He learns to read Russian, teaches himself German, teaches himself French. An amazingly talented autodidact. Leaves behind. Actually, it's not even fair to say. He moves with his family. His father ends up in Odessa for the business. Asher Ginsberg picks up the family business. He's an importer-exporter. That life brings him from Odessa. It also brings him to London. He lives in the Medieval neighborhood of London for a while, and ultimately to Eretz Yisrael, where he dies in the 1920s. Now, the interesting thing about this biography is that it sort of shares these components of the classic maskilic biography. Turn away from religion, it's the turn away from the sort of intensive Frumkeit in which he was raised, yet the need to replace it with something else. The difference between Achad Ha'am and a classic maskil is that he builds a very strong concept of what that something else is going to be. That something else is going to be thinking of the Jewish people as a nation, using all of these terms that he, along with Pinsker and other people who he met in Odessa. He starts a little circle, a conspiratorial society called the B'nai Moshe. Right? The B'nai Moshe is actually eventually a subset of a group called the Kibbutz Zion, or the Hovavet Zion. The Hovavet Zion was a kind of loosely confederated sort of circles of Jewish nationalists who were kind of talking about this idea of return to Eretz Israel, talking about cultivating Hebrew. In other words, they were kind of descendants of the Maskilim, right? Although many of them, a number of the Hovetzio, never made the turn away from religion that Achad Ha'am made. Achad Ha'am, some irony, forms the B'nai Moshe Society. So much of what he did was so very complicated. He pulls the B'nai Moshe Society. What the intent of the B'nai Moshe Society was to ferret into the Hovetzio and replace the religious content of the Kibbutz Zion that existed. His opinion was that religion was something that was an important relic of national identity, it was an important part of national identity, but it was destructive. It kept people passive. It kept them from doing what needed to be done, right? And so the B'nai Moshe Society, as my teacher who wrote a book on Achad Ha'am called it, was a ring of conspirators. So you can root into the Hovavet Zion and change it and direct it towards an intensively secular idea of national culture based upon Hebrew, historical education, cultural sort of commonality, and ultimately on a deeply Jewish but not religious conception of the nation. A little bit of text, just to get into this, and I'll read it because I realize I try to save paper and not do all of them in court, but my text is a little small. Some of his thoughts on religion give you an idea of what exactly he's after. Yet, I want to emphasize this point. The reason why I'm bringing this up is because the core of religion is always an issue for a Chacham, and he's acutely aware of its presence. It is not only the Jews who have come out of the ghetto, he writes, Judaism has come out too. For the Jews, the exodus from the ghetto is confined to certain countries and is due to toleration. But Judaism has come out, or is coming out of its own accord, wherever it has come into contact with modern culture. He's very aware of the influence. In a sense, it almost seems as though he sees religion. And he's not talking about the Reform movement, although that's part of it. He's talking about all aspects of religion. It's easily malleable to when it comes into contact with something else. It compromises the national fabric. This contact with modern culture overturns the inner defenses of Judaism so that it can no longer remain isolated and live a life apart. The spirit of our people desires further development. Note, he identifies something transcendent in the Jewish nation, something separate from religion. The spirit of our people desires further development. It wants to absorb the basic elements of general culture, which are reaching it from the outside world, to digest them and make them a part of itself. But the conditions of its life in exile are not suitable to such a task. We are compromising ourselves to our own peril by engaging when we are in the weakened state of exile. When it leaves the ghetto walls, it is in danger of losing its essential being, or at the very least, its national unity. It is in danger of being split up into as many kinds of Judaism, each with a different character in life, as there are countries of the dispersion. He writes about his own. Kibbutz Zion, which concerns itself with the preservation of Judaism at a time when Jewry is suffering so much, is something odd and unintelligible to the political Zionists, who we'll talk about. Of the West, just as the demand of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai for Yavna was strange and unintelligible to the comparable parties of its time. And so political Zionism cannot easily satisfy those Jews who care for Judaism. Its growth seems to them to be fraught with danger and subject to their own aspirations. He brings in a very insider reference, something that he knows the person to whom this essay was sort of targeted to, Theodor Herzl, who we'll talk to in a minute. Do not understand what is at stake when you're talking about the Jewish state. And it's something very real, and it's something that he's both a victim, potentially a victim of, but something that needs to utilize the impulses of this transcendent spirit, which itself is independent of specifically a religious context. Yet, note, he writes in beautiful Hebrew, and he uses a specific, in his writings, full of specific references to text, to things that he knows is a wink and a nod. Only people who know will understand what he's talking about. The second of our trio, Theodor Herzl. I call him a late awakening, although I don't think that's very fair because nobody was really awake or not awake. His arrival at Zionism was very late and based upon a constellation of factors that had very little to do with things that drove a Chacham. Right? He was the ultimate success story on a certain level as an assimilated Viennese Jew. Originally from Budapest, moved to Vienna, both from the Austro-Hungarian Empire, became a celebrity, really, through his writing in this newspaper, the Neue Freie Presse, which was, if you want to think about it this way, it was the newspaper of record of Central Europe, right in the late 19th century. He was successful in university, a popular guy. He was a member of this picture here represents a German dueling fraternity. The Nationalist Dueling Fraternity was a product of the 1848 period. It was a kind of place where young men in university could get together, much like the modern fraternity system in other universities where you get together, it's sort of brotherhood and a lot of drinking, beer, and singing nationalist songs, with the added element, and I'm glad that the American fraternity didn't pick this up, of when you drank enough and sung enough nationalist songs, going and picking fights with other fraternities and getting duels. This is going nuts, right? The whole idea was to prove what a tough guy you were by getting as many duels as you can. It's very interesting stuff. Herzl was involved in one of the very high level, very important one called the Albion Society. And interestingly, while he was a student, while he was in this fraternity, one of his fraternity brothers in a fit of patriotic fervor after the death of Richard Wagner, got up on the table and made this great lecture, or gave this great lecture, this great eulogy to Wagner, especially how he stuck it to the Jews. Okay. Herzl was there, saw this. Next day, he walks up to his to the council of his fraternity and says, this was an assault on my honor as a Jew. I insist that the person who made this speech be reprimanded, or I will leave the fraternity. The response was, the German equivalent of don't let the door hit you on the way out. Very soon thereafter, the Albion fraternity became a non-Jewish fraternity, excluded Jews. In fact, most of the fraternities in the Central European University system around this time ceased to admit Jews, which led to the creation of Jewish fraternities, but that's another story. Herzl, you know, he moved on from that upsetting moment, and he was a believer, he was a real believer in this, what I call the liberal promise, right? The promise of, now you understand I'm using the term liberal in this kind of 19th century context. The promise of, you know, continued progress and integration and, you know, leaving behind these so-called medieval superstitions.
Okay. Question? What was happening to the Moroccan or Algerian Jews when they looked
back in Europe? Oh, that's an interesting question. I'll tell you a little far afield. Very briefly, they are pretty much in a traditional model. They're still subject to mostly Islamic local states in sort of the Dindi system. A lot of them are being aided by the Alliance Islamique Universelle, sort of philanthropic movement. So there's a lot of them. Herzl was in Paris as the sort of Paris bureau of the Neue Freie Presse when the Dreyfus Affair occurred. Now, it's traditionally understood that, mostly through the very influential biography by Alex Fine, that, you know, Herzl saw Dreyfus degraded. He was there, so here's Dreyfus being degraded. You know, he was in this crowd back there. He saw the whole thing. Now, the story is that's what turned him to become a nationalist. Now, I suggest that that's quite oversimplified. He happened to have been growing up, coming of age in Vienna, where the mayor, ultimately in the mid-1890s, was elected on an anti-Semitic platform. So the entire percolation of anti-Semitism in local politics in Vienna was ever present. And I would suggest there's a lot more to that story. So what is Herzl's relationship to this question of religion? So very interestingly, mostly because of a kind of discourse that was set up by a Chachamim who did not like Herzl one thing. Long story short, around 1896, Herzl comes out, publishes this booklet called Der Judenstaat, the Jewish State, where he asserts, look, what we really need to do is have a Jewish state. That's basically it. And he goes about saying how we do that, what it means. Much of what he wrote could have been written by the Open Experiment. He had no awareness of the entire context of Jewish nationalism that had been growing up since about 1882. It's not an exaggeration to say that he had really no awareness. I mean, he writes about it himself. He says, repeatedly in his diary, when someone gives him a booklet, says, oh, you should read this. Oh, Neil Kinzer, Otto Matzel Passer. Oh, I didn't read that. I mean, this is 1899, right? He says, so, writes the huge, comes out as this Jewish nationalist and encounters this whole body of Jewish nationalists, now properly called Zionists, who say, well, wait a minute, I mean, we're glad to have you on board, but, you know, we're here for you, and you better fall into line with what we're talking about. He would have none of it at all, and probably it's good, because he was able to dispense with a lot of the infighting that was going on among the various little Zionist groups that did exist, and he was able to rally very successfully the sentiment of Jewish nationalism to his cause, and furthermore, as a very good-looking man, a very a celebrity in Central European popular literature, a person who people knew, man of means, wealthy, right? He was able to pull a lot of people in who otherwise might not have been so drawn to it. In other words, he made it look, to a certain degree, credible. He made Jewish nationalism look credible. As I sort of put it to my students sometimes, he changed the movement from the kind of people who down in Washington Square hand out leaflets, you know, to
of, you know, men wearing tuxedos and top hats and big lecture halls in Basel, right? And he gave it credibility.
1902, he makes a crucial misstep.
He writes a novel called Avoyelles, which is a novel modeled after Edward Bellamy's book, Looking Backwards, right? It's a utopian novel which imagines 20 years down the line what the Jewish state will look like. And it's this wonderful, it's a socialist utopian, interestingly enough, on the forefront of technology and science and agricultural science and culture, where all the faiths of the world are kind of brought together in a happy sort of unity. It's really, you know, in a way, it's kind of Hessian. It's like what the Moses Hess was sort of imagining. You know, the return of the Jews to Eretz Israel would bring about sort of world, you know, it's a very messianic vision, right? Writes it in this novel, and Ahmad is able to use that as a knife to finally try to stab it in the back of his upstart as deeply as he could, because what it seemed to do was show a Jewish state that was devoid of any clear understanding of what it means to be a Jew. That was his argument. This is just, he called it a monkey's imitation of Western Jewish culture. In other words, it was aping Vienna, right? Aping this sort of disgusting, scraping, called it an example of Avdut v'toch Herut, right? I mean, he was extremely, extremely negative. I would suggest, however, that looking at the novel a little bit differently, actually looking at it without thinking about what Ahmad Ham says about it, is a very interesting phenomenon that occurs afterwards, is that most people responding to this novel on a subconscious level are responding to it through the perspective of Ahmad Ham. They're already reading Herzl as being someone who had no idea what Yiddish was. They're reading Herzl as this kind of, you know, derogatory, but sort of like, you know, this big dumb boy, you know, who decides he wants to be Jewish all of a sudden, right? And I would suggest that that's a mistake. And the reason why I say that, here's an example from the text. The climax of the novel, beautiful scene in the novel. The main character is a guy named Friedrich Löwenberg, who is kind of Herzl's doppelganger in the novel. Sort of his voice is carried through this figure, has this epiphany. When he's come on this tour through how Israel has been rebuilt, he's brought finally to the climax of the story occurs during Pesach. So it's really an Aliyah HaRegel, and he's really ascending, you know, he's in the temple. He's actually in the temple. The rebuilt temple, as he imagines. Which, you know, people point out was a lot like the Reform Synagogue. This isn't how he imagined. This is from a journal called Austin Vest, which was a contemporary journal of Herzl. He's very, very, very pro-Herzlian, but also very pro-Achadahar, and they published both. They were interested in all kinds of Jewish culture with a kind of nationalist orientation. This is what an artist imagined the temple would look like. And he writes, as Friedrich's sitting there, suddenly as Friedrich listened to the music and meditated on the thoughts it inspired, the significance of the temple flashed upon him. In the days of King Solomon, it had been a gorgeous symbol, adorned with gold and precious stones, attesting to the might and pride of Israel. And however splendid it may have been, the Jew could not have grieved for it for 18 centuries long. No, they sighed for an invisible something of which the stones had been a symbol. It had come to rest in the rebuilt temple, where stood the home-returning sons of Israel, who lifted up their souls to the invisible God as their fathers had done on Mount Moriah. The words of Solomon glowed with new vitality, quote, "The Lord hath said that he would dwell in the thick of darkness. I have surely built thee a house of habitation, a place for thee to dwell." Now, I have to admit, I think this is very powerful. I also would like to point out that he's utilizing a very, I posit that there's always complexity of the way an author interrelates with his character. It's never reducible to simply Herzl, you know, putting kind of autobiography through the mouth of a character, right? I would say in this case, though, my feeling is there's something going on. Herzl was very, very reluctant to take a position vis-a-vis religion as the sort of titular head of the Zionist movement, right? Now, why was that? Well, because it was dangerous. He did not want to alienate, nor did he want to move the direction of movement in one way or another. His interest was in whatever you had to do to get the state, you do to get the state. Very pragmatic. This is not a pragmatic set. That's another thing. But the question of culture and the question of religion were the two most difficult questions in early Zionism. You had a Chavahah on the question of culture, arguing that we needed to be very explicit and very robust in what we were talking about. We're talking about the national culture. We're talking about something very real that has nothing to do with this living idea that sort of the kind of, you know, what do you call, you probably refer to as the ghetto, right? It didn't have anything to do with that. It had to do with creating a modern national identity. The push by people who admire Fatah to inject that, to make that a centerpiece of the Zionist platform, Herzl recognized was a disaster waiting to happen. He actually hoped to court the religious people of Central Eastern. He believed he could. And to a certain degree, he was right. I'll give you an example of why. The thing that was seen as Herzl's biggest disaster, his biggest faux pas, the reason, the thing that really proved that Herzl had no idea what it meant to be a Jew, was something called the Uganda Proposal of 1903. Six times Palestinian. Uganda Proposal. What was the Uganda Proposal? Basically, Herzl had been trying to sort of navigate a kind of set up some kind of political tête-à-tête to get, you know, to get somehow funding to sort of really kind of get on the ground some kind of Jewish infrastructure in Ottoman Palestine. And he'd been talking with the colonial office in Great Britain. And at one point, British colonial officer had been able to secure a promise that we had, from the British imperial perspective, we had a place in Western Africa. The Jews need a place to go. And keep in mind, it's an extraordinarily dangerous period. But when the Uganda proposal was floated, it was right after the Kishinev pogroms, the worst pogroms that Jews had experienced since the Milnitsky. Think about that. It's in 1648, the worst. And Herzl said, well, I mean, we're in trouble. You know, we need to do something. This led to a big walkout. It's very famous. The Democratic faction, so-called, the followers, mostly of Abraham, got up, left the conference. Who stayed? Well, on the one hand, you have people who supported Herzl. You know, it was close. You know, Nordau, it was on the those people. You also had the Mizrahi. Not the Mizrahi, the Mizrahi religious Zionists, and Rabbi Yaakov stayed, were willing to entertain this idea, right? Which shows to me a couple of things. First of all, it shows the pragmatic aspect of Herzl's model was something that could potentially appeal to a broader group of people. And it also proved, in my opinion, that Afakam's dismissal and subsequent historical dismissals of Herzl's awareness of religion was far too simplified. Our final figure, Dr. Nathan Birnbaum. Nathan Birnbaum was, first of all, the originator of the term Zionism. One of the earliest Zionists in Vienna, founder of a society called the Kadima Society around 1883, that was inspired by this man, Peretz Molenskin. Peretz Molenskin had been living in Vienna since 1868. Where was he from? Well, he was originally from Lithuania via Odessa. He was around Odessa at the same time as people like Sforim, Kinsker, knew all these people. Came to Vienna and started publishing his own journal, Hashachar, Hebrew journal in Vienna. I can make the joke, but the only two people who subscribed to the journal were him and the chief rabbi of Vienna, of Jelinek, who was actually supporting Molenskin to publish the journal. Yeah. Jelinek had a very academic interest in Hebrew. He queued in with these young university students, Birnbaum, and I just want to point out, Birnbaum was in university exactly the same time as Taylor Herzl. Birnbaum is hanging out with your student. Right? He's hanging out with the Jews who come to Vienna from eastern parts of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, mostly for medical school, right, to educate themselves. That's the place where you go if you're going to become a surgeon or a doctor, or in Birnbaum's case, a lawyer. You came to Vienna. So there was a pretty healthy number of so-called Ostjuden, you know, learning, studying medicine in Vienna. He gets hooked in with them. They hook in with Smolenskin, and out of that is born a movement called the Kadima, Kadima Society, the first student Jewish National Society in Central Europe.
He is also the editor, primary founder, through a tiny little inheritance that his father left him. He spent all of it founding this newspaper. I've already mentioned it, Selbst Emanzipation. This is the first page of the first issue. I want to note that he uses this term. It's hard to read. The term that he uses in the announcement of the publication of this letter, they always like to do this in these newspapers. The first issue, first page of the first issue always has some big statement of purpose. Right? It starts off with the word Amesgenossen. What does that mean? It means, well, hard to say exactly what it means. It means people of the tribe, right? Literally. But it's a distinctively ethnic term. People who are of the Jewish people, right? Stam's people. It's a very specific choice. Highlighting that he sees this, right, as part of the same model of Pinsker, very close to the model of Chacham. In fact, over his career, while he's still a Zionist, he's a very big supporter of the Chacham, and, not surprisingly, a big opponent of Theodor Herzl. In fact, they did not get along at all. This is a picture from, this is the group collage of the first Zionist Congress in 1897. Here is Herzl. He would be right in the middle. I kind of cropped it, but he's right in the middle. And if you go up, there's Birbal. Birbal was actually the first secretary, the first general secretary of the Political Actions Committee of the World Zionist Organization, the first paid employee, almost, more or less, first paid executive, let's say, of the Zionist organization. Birnbaum does not get along with Herzl. That's not the only reason, but it's part of the reason that he leaves behind the World Zionist Organization in 1899, walks away from it. Herzl is dismissive, Herzl is hard to work for, Herzl doesn't think Birnbaum is really contributing anything to the movement, Birnbaum walks away. Birnbaum is a celebrity by this point, not in the same way as Herzl, but, as this photograph shows, he had a certain degree of celebrity among the East European Jews of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Try to take that on the road and run as a Jewish nationalist candidate for the Austrian Parliament. He was part of a set of five different thinkers who ran for office in the Austro-Hungarian Parliament. This is him on a whistle stop in Buchach, right? Very significant city in the Galician region of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Birnbaum is right here. This is the crowd. And I want to point out something. They're not all Jews. In fact, a big chunk of them are Ukrainians. In fact, this is a campaign poster from that election. Bratia Rusini, right? My Ruthenian brothers. Best interests of you is to vote for Natana Birnbaum, right? They wanted to push. He successfully ran, well, he didn't successfully, but he successfully courted a significant percentage of the Ukrainian vote on a nationalist platform. And he lost the election. Okay, it's not because of the Ukrainians, it wasn't his fault. It happened to be that the Buchach region had one of the most intensively working Polish political machines. The Polish nationalist candidate was able to dominate the election through a mostly really nasty campaign fraud, something that would look familiar to, you know, sort of failed states today.
Why would the non-Jews support him? He's known for his Zionist inclinations. Maybe they're happy to get the Jews out.
A is the perfect question, and B is the right answer. No, it wasn't to get the Jews out, it was to keep the Jews separate. The Ukrainians were the one group who was not interested in Jews integrating into their culture. In that region, there were three groups. There were Ruthenians or Ukrainians, there were Poles, there were Jews. There were some Germans and others. Ukrainians were about 42% of the population. Poles were about 41% of the population. Jews were in the neighborhood of 9 to 10% of the population. The goal of electoral politics then was controlling that group, right? The balance of power, right? Jews had always been counted by the census as being Poles in that region because the Poles controlled the census. 1907, there was the introduction of universal suffrage in Galicia, throughout the empire. All of a sudden, Jews were able to put themselves forward as an independent voice, and the Ukrainians realized that was a chance to tip the scales, and Birnbaum was seen as their guy. He ran in a runoff against the Ukrainian candidate. The Ukrainian candidate walks to Birnbaum, and the Ukrainian candidate then told all of his people to go over to Birnbaum. Very interesting. But he lost, so he moved in a different direction, towards Yiddish. Now, Yiddish and national autonomy, those are the tools of Birnbaum's nationalism.
religion is always something there, but it's not there. You know, I mean, he grew up in a traditional household. His parents were Galician immigrants to Vienna, but he really left behind that as a, an active part of his identity. The Yiddish, this is a picture from the first conference of the Yiddish language in 1908, first and only conference of the Yiddish language in 1908. You see Birnbaum here, right here, and there is Yitzhak Levi Peretz. Here is Chaim Zhidlovsky. Big picture, the big event that went absolutely nowhere. Something interesting happened. Something very interesting happened to Birnbaum. Between 1910 and 1914, in the year leading up in the First World War. He lives in Chernivtsi. Chernivtsi was the place where this this conference happened. Chernivtsi is in a state called Bukovina. It's the farthest eastern state in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It's right on the Russian border. Right now it's a part of the Ukraine. He lives in Chernivtsi for a couple of years after the conference, trying to get something started, trying to sort of work on increasing the Yiddish cultural component of the Chernivtsi public, Jewish public life. Chernivtsi was very much a German-speaking Jewish town. Most people don't realize that. But then something happened. He went back to Vienna. He was actually touring around Europe. He was a well-known person. I mean, he was a correspondent with people like Martin Buber. He was admired by Franz Rosenzweig. I mean, like this whole who's who of sort of Central European German Jewish intellectuals saw Birnbaum as an important figure in Finland. And then, around 1914, he kind of disappears from view. It's the beginning of the First World War. He has three sons serving in the Austrian army. He kind of gets a job working in the Jewish war archive in Vienna, which is a Zionist enterprise to sort of document the impact of the war on Jews. And he becomes a Balchuk. He writes about it a little bit later, 1919. Thus the years passed until the day came. I don't remember anymore which day it was. That the thread was rent as if by itself, and I knew God. He was opened up to me in all his manifest presence as the creator and the kingly personality of the world. I comprehended that of all the objects I had held about him and his being that I invented showed only his inaccessibility. It did not cast doubt on his existence. And everything appeared to me so simply that I could not comprehend how I had stood in opposition for so long to this elementary realization and persisted in obsessing over such an obvious triviality, i.e. his ugly. Now all was clear to me, my story of suffering for the previous years was but a single great announcement of the all-powerful before his entry into my consciousness. Now this is pretty heady stuff. I mean, I spent the last 10 years of my life reading about everything Birnbaum has written. And this is, wow, it's like a bombshell. It's huge. He writes this in 1919 after he'd already sort of announced himself. Just to give you a sense, he was eventually moved into the somewhat young Agudas Yisrael, the Agudat Yisrael. The Aguda was founded in 1912 by on a specifically anti-Zionist platform in Katowice, so right over the border of Russian Poland and German Poland. 1916, it expanded greatly through the efforts of a pair of founders of the Aguda sort of moving through Poland and kind of organizing cells of the Aguda throughout Poland, and eventually got the support of the Gera Rebbe, which allowed it to really explode and become the Aguda that we know. Very significant Orthodox political group, probably the most successful Orthodox, modern Orthodox political, not modern Orthodox, modern, comma, Orthodox political movement. Important distinction. Birnbaum remained frum for the rest of his life. He published self-published two different journals on Orthodox thought. This was the latter one, Der Ruf, or the call. The earlier one was called Der Aufstieg, the ascension. Right? The reason why he called it the ascension was he had pioneered an idea about how to reinvigorate what he viewed as a sort of decline, a kind of decrepitude within the Orthodox world. And he came up with this idea of the Olim. And he happened to be working with a nephew of the Vishnitzer Rebbe by the name of Tuvia Horowitz. This Tuvia Horowitz, it turns out, was very instrumental in helping Birnbaum become frum on a practical level. Remembering how to daven, Birnbaum starts, essentially essentially comporting himself like a chassid. He sort of adopts this sort of Hasidic derech. But the Olim movement was a model. It's a very interesting occurring here. This on the right, that's your left, excuse me, the left, is from the initial pamphlet called the Divrei HaOlim. This kind of came out of nowhere. Him and Tuvia Horowitz are sort of sitting and writing this thing down. They put it out there. Birnbaum has just kind of come out as being a new from person. All of these people who knew him from before don't know what to make of it. Here's what he says. He says, the main thing that we need to do is create a new institution that assists in matters of service of the Creator, especially in training of synagogue leaders in the Bitei Midrash and other holy places, to guard and to organize businesses and works and the occupation of the Olim. This new group of people, of these Orthodox youths, are supposed to be called the Olim. That's why the term is the Divrei HaOlim. Interesting, the terminology used is already why I choose the word Olim. To guard and organize the work of mercy within the community, to attend to distributed splendor among the people by means of objects, by means of clothing. He's talking about tzedakah. Finally, it is not with our words alone that we should come to our brothers and sisters, but also with our lives and our deeds. And we demand of them their lives and their deeds. And our hope is strong that they will come to us at once, and more, until the entire assembly of Israel will be one single union of Olim, defended by their guards, one single union of those true to the Torah, and those that strive for justice and holiness, and which are committed to the bring of the Messiah. He puts this out and gets the attention of the Aguda. The Aguda, might not realize this, was actually a pretty radical organization in this day. It's very attractive to young Orthodox people, to young from men and women, right? Who could not abide by the direction of the Zionist movement had gone, and felt the need for some kind of political organization. Now, people say, well, that means that Birnbaum became an anti-Zionist. Well, in a sense, it's true. If you think of Zionism as this political, anti-religious political organization that seemed to be pulling people in at the expense of religiosity. But if you look at his work, and I'll end with this, if you look at his work as he's working with the Aguda, it's a little more complicated than that. The question about Zionism, right? Our youth must make their will known. The Jewish question will be addressed at the peace conference. Zionist claims Palestine is the property of the Jewish people and demands national autonomy for the mass colonization of the land. Our position has been, up to this point, to oppose this claim with the vast majority of the Jewish people of Torah true Jewry, to fight against it with all our might. We stand before the alternative to make at the peace conference the national claims of Jewry open and honorable to our own. What does that mean? Make the claims of national Jewry open and honorable to our own. In other words, to reverse what a Chacham did. You want to think about it that way. To re-inject with some concept of nationalism, a true religious core that really exists. Fear about the national, sort of bringing together these very desperate, at this point, strands of identity. It is also taken as though it is only a matter of politics. Well, it is a matter close to the heart of all true Jews, precisely because we are Torah Jews, because it is an Eretz Yisrael, that we will see the fulfillment of our Torah ideals. Because of Eretz Yisrael, we will come to our own. We must state it clearly and frankly. Precisely because we will fight non-religious nationalism with all our power, we must create a real religious nationalism in the land. Palestine must not be given to the Zionist organization. It must be given to the Jewish people. Now, just in conclusion, three different ways in which the question of religion is confronted by three of the early Zionist thinkers, all of which go very different ways, yet at the same time shows the core preoccupation of religion in Zionism. I'm sorry, any questions?